From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food.
Dumplings, whole fish, chicken, pork, long noodles for long life, New Year's cake, and to top it off, my personal favorite is tang yuan, or sticky rice balls stuffed with sweet black sesame. They are a must-have at the end of the traditional Chinese New Year festival, which lasts for 15 days.
That's Christine Zhang, ticking off the food she'll be eating at her Chinese New Year celebration. Zhang and her colleagues at the LA Times made a very cool interactive post with recipes of dishes to try for the Chinese New Year. Find a link on our website. Many revelers will also usher in the year of the rooster with tofu. I recently talked to food writer Fuchsia Dunlop about her new cookbook, Land of Fish and Rice. She shared some of her tofu recipes with us.
There are lots of different forms of tofu in China, and it's a very important form of food. And when it's prepared well, it can be absolutely delicious. Again, sometimes cooked in stock or with a little meat or with some pickled vegetables to enhance its flavor. So in Yangzhou, which is in the Jiangnan region, they love tofu gan, which is pressed tofu. So it's firm enough to cut into matchstick thin slivers. And that's something you might often have for breakfast there or for dinner. And there's also some lovely recipes for silken tofu or flour tofu, you know, with sprinkling of seasonings, which is, again, a sort of very soothing and delicious food for breakfast or lunch. And then you also get sort of smoked and spiced tofu, which again is firm enough to be sliced and stir-fried. And there's one recipe in the books, stir-frying it with pickled vegetables, which is nice. That's from Ningbo, which is a coastal city in the region. So yes, and another thing is that this region is very strong on Buddhist vegetarian cookery, where you put all your artfulness into making vegetarian ingredients look and taste like meat or fish. So there's a recipe in the book for vegetarian roast duck from Hangzhou, and that's where you take tofu skins, so that's the skins that form on simmering soybean milk, and you can buy them dried in Chinatowns. So you basically wrap them up in layers and flavor them with a lovely broth seasoned with sort of soy sauce and sugar and wine, and then you steam it and then deep fry it, and you end up with something that actually looks very like gorgeously golden roast duck breast and has this very nice sort of meaty consistency and a very delectable flavor, but it's completely vegetarian.
Wow. Is it one region that you're following, and what is it called?
It's a region encompassing Shanghai and Zhejiang and Jiangsu provinces with the southern part of Anhui province. And it's often referred to as the Jiangnan region, which literally means south of the river, meaning south of the Yangtze River. So there have been, or there are, a number of different ways of referring to the cuisine of this part of China. Sometimes people talk of Huaiyang cooking, which is a somewhat old-fashioned now term for this style of cooking. And some people talk about Su cooking, meaning the cooking of Jiangsu province. But Jiangnan sort of expresses the region as a whole, which is why I've chosen to use it.
What characterizes the food there, and why is it less known in the West than Cantonese or Sichuan cooking?
Well, in China, it's really, you know, arguably the great cuisine. You know, the Jiangnan region has for centuries been a center of gastronomy. It's been the region where poets and writers have and emperors have fallen in love with the food and written about it. And it's talked about as having flavors that are very gentle, qingdan, which literally means pure and light in Chinese. So very even-tempered, soothing, comfortable, lightly flavored dishes, which emphasize the ben wei, the essential taste of the ingredients. But that's not to say that it's sort of dull, because you also get wonderful red braised dishes made with soy sauce and rice wine and sugar, like red braised pork, and some gorgeous drunken dishes, which are foods that are steeped in Shaoxing rice wine, and also some very exciting funky fermented foods. So, you know, a good meal always is a journey and exciting variety of tastes. And it's a region also known for highly sophisticated cooking techniques. Some of the more elaborate dishes are called kung fu dishes because they're so complicated, like the martial arts, but also for simple seasonal farmhouse cooking and home cooking. But it is sort of very neglected in the West. And I think one of the reasons is that we just haven't seen the same waves of immigrants as we had from the Cantonese South, for example, bringing the flavours to the West. And also maybe it's less easy to stereotype. You know, with Sichuanese cooking, you can talk about chilies and Sichuan pepper and everyone knows what you're talking about. But this cuisine is a bit more subtle and a bit less easy to sum up in a single sentence or soundbite.
Would you read a piece from your book about crab?
All right. The 17th century playwright Li Yu wrote, "When it comes to crabs, while my heart lusts after them and my mouth enjoys their delectable taste, and in my whole life there has not been a single day when I have forgotten them, I can't even begin to describe or make clear why I love them, why I adore their sweet taste, and why I can never forget them. From the first day of the crab season until the last day they are sold, I do not let a single evening pass without eating them. Dear crab, you and I, are we to be lifelong companions?"
This piece that you just read is so extraordinary. Talk about that season a bit. Give us some idea of what it's like being in that region when the crabs are ready.
Oh, well, people in this region are really obsessed with eating the finest produce in exactly the right season. And the crabs mature towards the end of the lunar year in the autumn. And then people in Suzhou and Shanghai just become obsessed. And restaurants have special crab menus with a whole lot of dishes all made with crab meat. So the most basic, you can just have steamed crabs and you tear them apart with your fingers. And it's a messy, sort of wonderful business. And you extract all the delicious meat and you dip it into vinegar spiked with ginger and you drink it with Shaoxing wine. But if you don't want the mess, or if you just want a bit more extravagant deliciousness as well, you can have dishes like the crab legs, which are very small because these are tiny crabs. The crab legs stir-fried with asparagus, or the crab meat, which might be stir-fried with ginger and rice wine and then spooned over very tender silken tofu. So it's a really ambrosial dish. You have crab meat with lovely, vibrant emerald greens or with noodles, really anything you like spiked with crab meat.
Looking through the book and really reading through the recipes, it strikes me that this is a food that's really meant to be cooked at home, that maybe we, particularly in Southern California, when we go out, we want to like have that sort of macho fire mouth experience. But at home, the recipes seem so approachable and healthful. I mean, just so direct.
Yeah. And this is, in China, it's seen as being a very healthy cuisine, as being very balanced. There are lots and lots of vegetables, and meat and fish are often used as sort of flavoring principles rather than the main ingredient. So it's a very sort of happy and healthy and sustainable way of eating, really. So, one of the reasons that I've written about it is that I think that the cooking of this region really offers some kind of creative solutions to some of the problems we all have now in the West, which is how to eat more vegetables and still really enjoy our food, how to eat less meat without feeling that we're making some major sacrifice. And the other thing is about the region that it resonates very strongly with some, modern foodie concerns, like this sort of interest in where food comes from, eating food from the right place in the right season. Yeah, and the whole culture of discussing food and writing about it and going into rhapsodies about it, like that playwright Li Yu when it came to crabs.
You have one soup in the book where it looks like a bowl of extremely fine noodles, but you describe it as turnip, or is it soy, that's sliced paper thin and then cut and in this incredible way that's so super fine?
Oh, yes. That's the famous Yangzhou Wunsi tofu soup. And it's named after a monk from Yangzhou, who apparently used to make a vegetarian version. And the chefs of Yangzhou are famous for their knife skills and for being able to cut tofu into improbably slender strands. So for that, you need a block of silken tofu, and it's almost like a meditation. So you're slicing the knife up and down and hardly moving it. So you get these incredibly thin sheets of tofu, and then you gently lay them out on your board and you cut them into strands. So that's one of the trickier recipes, but it's quite fun to have a go.
So who are the gastronomic pioneers that are taking over the restaurant scene in this region now? What's happening in the kitchens?
Well, I mean, China has been through a period of sort of earth-shattering change, really. So, you know, after all the revolution, we've had these decades of rapid opening up, industrialization and social change. So there's a real challenge, and the threat of sort of losing of artisanal skills and traditional cooking skills. But there are some people who I've found inspirational in the region who are doing their best to ensure that these traditions are sort of nurtured and handed on. And one in particular is a friend of mine now to whom the book is dedicated, and that's Dai Jianjun, otherwise known as Adai, who's the owner of a remarkable restaurant in Hangzhou called the Dragon Well Manor. And it's a kind of Chez Panisse of China, really. And he goes to great lengths to source the best ingredients from what we would call organic farms deep in the countryside, and to encourage farmers to, for example, rear livestock in the traditional ways, to go on making pickles and preserves and wine in the traditional way. So he's both sort of giving consumers the chance to taste very traditional dishes, everything from high-level complicated kung fu dishes to real simple farmhouse cooking, but made with very fine ingredients. And he's also trying to encourage people in the countryside to value their traditions and to be able to make an honest living from supplying very high-quality traditional products. So what he's doing is absolutely remarkable.
Fuchsia Dunlop's new book is Land of Fish and Rice. As always, you can find recipes from this conversation and from many, many more I've had with chefs, farmers, and food writers on our blog. Just go to blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. In America, Chinese cuisine has had a long and complicated history. But food, as it often does, has long helped immigrants find their footings in unfamiliar and discriminatory settings. Food writer and culinary historian Anne Mendelsohn surveys the journey of Chinese food in America in her new book, Chow Chop Suey. When and how did Chinese food first find its way to the States?
It first got here during the gold rush, with Chinese who came to participate in the gold craze. Among the things that they brought with them were skills in founding restaurants.
So were they already restaurant men before arriving?
They were men who cooked, very few women. You have to pardon my cough. I managed to get some miserable bug. From dealing with Western powers already in Canton province across the Pacific, they had become very skilled at gauging the culinary tastes of Westerners. They were able to set up restaurants almost from the beginning in 1849-50.
So these restaurants, were they geared to the Western client?
Some, yes. We have records of Westerners going to Chinese restaurants in the early 1850s and eating Western food prepared to their taste, as well as Chinese food for those who wanted to be more adventurous. Broiled or stewed meats, they could cook steaks, excellent coffee.
Did these restaurants start to accumulate in what we would call a Chinatown, or did they strike out in different neighborhoods?
They were concentrated in the neighborhood that was first called Little China, which was the precursor to San Francisco Chinatown. To some extent, as Chinese people pushed out into the boondocks looking for gold, in some of the towns they went through or settled in along the way, they founded little restaurants. But things started turning in a very unfortunate direction almost instantly after the mid-1850s.
What do you mean by that, an unfortunate direction?
The Chinese rapidly found that they were viewed with more and more disfavor and even hatred by whites, especially leaders of the young, the very infant American labor movement, who pointed to the way Chinese would take jobs They would work incredible hours at very lowly jobs, at wages much, much lower than white people were accustomed to. And everybody saw this as competing for honest jobs, taking them away from decent white working men. The enmity grew and grew. Chinese kept coming because there were so many terrible things going on in China itself, both natural disasters, political upheavals, wars, famines. The Chinese kept coming from Guangdong province, Canton province in South China, especially from one very poor, hardscrabble district called Toshan. They had great organization. They had labor brokers dispatching them overseas from Hong Kong, a continuous pipeline of Chinese being ferried across the Pacific, arriving in California, which came to be the place of greatest friction and hatred, striking out into the other Pacific and Rocky Mountain states. The gold didn't really pan out very well for anybody after the first few years. But during the Civil War, the Transcontinental Railroad project got started, and the builders of the line traveling east from California toward Utah realized that the Chinese made better workers. This, again, was a strike against them in the view of white laborers, but the Chinese ended up greatly outnumbering whites on that line of the railroad being built eastward from California.
Did the development of restaurants start to fan out from the railroad line?
No, it was pretty unrelated. What they did was to start coming east, where they were not loved exactly, but they were not being killed and persecuted as egregiously. So they came to the Midwest, they came to parts of the South, and especially they came to New York, where they founded what eventually became the biggest Chinatown in the U.S. And it was there that the Chinese restaurant culture, or Chinese-American restaurant culture, really took hold.
Chop suey was the term used for the cuisine as a whole by white America. What's the etymology of the phrase and Americans' understanding of it at the time?
White people went to Chinese restaurants and encountered dishes they liked, and there was absolutely no way of communicating the names accurately. So there certainly on many restaurant menus would have been a dish called chow chop suey, meaning stir-fried bits and odds and ends. And there would have been other dishes called chow ya, stir-fried duck, or chow xia, stir-fried shrimp. But trying to communicate the name of a dish that white patrons had liked turned out to be just about impossible. White patrons cottoned onto the idea that there was a whole class of dishes called chop suey, and you could have chop suey duck or chop suey shrimp, while the Chinese characters on Chinese menus went on saying stir-fried duck, stir-fried shrimp, and so forth.
Let's move forward a little, maybe towards the 40s. Could you talk a little bit about chows, how to cook and eat in Chinese?
This is still thought by some people to be the best English-language Chinese cookbook ever written. The author was Bue Yang Chow. She had originally been a doctor, one of the first woman physicians in China, but she married a very great linguist, a man by the name of Yuan Ren Chow, had four daughters with him, and ended up during World War II living in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he was teaching the Chinese language. And she concentrated on writing a cookbook in Chinese. Her oldest daughter translated a text as she went along. The existence of this book came to the attention of Pearl Buck, whose husband was the head of one of the few American publishers that took Chinese subjects seriously. Pearl Buck took one look at this manuscript. She thought English-language Chinese cookbooks were terrible. She had never seen one that answered her idea of good Chinese food from having been brought up from early childhood in China. And she galloped into the kitchen and started cooking. Because of the input of Mrs. Chow's daughter and her husband, who were both fluent in English, she was not, it ended up being the first book to try to bridge the language gap, to try to translate the concepts of Chinese techniques and Chinese understandings of what ingredients were and how they were to be deployed. Well, this was the book that coined the term stir fry. One of the readers hired by the publisher to evaluate the manuscript said, stir fry. Well, you know, if it may make a little sense, but it's just an awkward coinage. But Pearl Buck and her husband and the Chows stuck to their guns, and stir fry remained in the book because it so eloquently expressed what goes on in a wok when you perform this chow technique, stir fry.
You know, so much of what you've told us today has resonance with what we fear may be going on here. Can you draw any correlations between our current state of affairs and the evolution of Chinese food in America?
I'm afraid they're all too obvious correlations. The hostility that the Chinese, as a group isolated from white mainstream ways, the hostility that they faced for generations was almost unique until recent times. No group other than African Americans and Native Americans has ever been persecuted so systematically for wanting to come to this country and work. Their presence was interpreted as a threat to American jobs. Their culture was seen as barbarous. Their religion was seen as idolatrous. They were not proper Christians in a Christian country. It took generations for their political fortunes to change. Almost everything about Chinese American history has to be seen in a context of racial politics. And the only reason that things suddenly turned around and the Chinese went from carving out a niche existence with restaurants and laundries to being regarded as real American patriots, the only reason was World War II, when China came into the war on the side of the U.S. And all of a sudden, Madame Chiang Kai-shek was addressing both houses of Congress. Chinese guys were signing up in droves for the draft. Chinese pilots had started participating in bombing missions even before the U.S. entered the war. Chinese American pilots had gone overseas. Suddenly, this dual patriotism was applauded by everybody. And although there was some regression after World War II, still, the threshold had been breached, and for the first time, Chinese were explicitly allowed to become American citizens.
Thank you so much, Anne.
Well, you're welcome.
Feel better. Go home.
Yeah, thank you.
Read more about the evolution of American Chinese food in Anne Mendelsohn's new book, Chow Chop Suey, Food and the Chinese American Journey. Up next, we hear where to ring in the Chinese New Year in Los Angeles from our favorite food critic. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman.
There is a special list of lucky foods that you're supposed to eat. fish to make you richer and dumplings to make you richer and spring rolls to make you richer and noodles to make you live a really long life.
That's LA Times food critic Jonathan Gold talking about food you should eat to usher in the year of the rooster.
And oranges to
make you fertile?
No, I think it's to make you richer again. Anything that sort of like looks like money is
like
money.
It's golden, I see.
Yeah.
Okay. With such a plethora of choices, do you opt for comfort?
I opt for good taste, as I always do. I mean, you could go to one of the, you know, giant splashy Cantonese places, which is always fun. The one on my list this year is Jie Zhao in Tustin. It's just massive and it's ornate. If you feel like spending fortunes instead of
hoping to get fortunes by eating the food.
I mean, they have all the priciest things from the Chinese table, but it's like a really good place to go for urban few soups or crackly skinned suckling pigs or dim sum. The dim sum is the best in Orange County.
It's the kind of place where you want to really go with a ton of people.
Yeah, that way the giant lobster you're getting, and you should get the giant lobster because it's really delicious, will somehow become economical.
Okay.
Speaking of giant lobsters, it's the big fad in the San Gabriel Valley now. Big lobsters fried with spices and chopped scallions and chilies. And it started at a place called Newport Seafood. The original one was in Orange County, I think, but very soon after it opened in San Gabriel itself. There's this lobster the size of a spaniel.
I could never eat it now. Thank you. Thank you for that illusion.
No, okay. It's a lobster the size of a much larger lobster. And it's fried with all kinds of aromatics. And it's a little bit crusty on the outside. And it's chopped up so that you can easily get the meat out. But it's not separated from its shell because you want all the spicy stuff in the sauce that's going on in the stir frying.
Yeah, you want to suck on the shells.
Yeah. There's a bunch of Newports now. There's even one in Beverly Hills. People complain the menu is too small, but the only thing you ever get there is the lobster. You get shaking beef, which is like sort of a Vietnamese stir-fried beef. You get pea pod leaves sauteed with garlic, and maybe you get clams with basil.
So you don't need a giant menu.
You don't need a giant menu. You need four things on the menu. And they know what you're getting the second you walk in. It's not a mystery. You're not going to go suddenly to page 13 and decide that you want the sea cucumber. They know you're not going to get the sea cucumber.
So given that noodles are an important part of the ritual foods to eat for a long life, to get that long life, you must slurp them complete and not break them with your teeth. Where should we go?
Ordinarily, I would say Mian. And Mian is great for Sichuan noodles. I don't need a holiday occasion to go there. I'm really up on a place called China Tasty, which is tucked in behind a bowling alley in Alhambra. They might be the only place in this part of town to have the real sort of Lanzhou-style hand-pulled noodles, which are chewy and kind of elastic, hand-thrown to order. I get them as like jiajangmian, but you can get them a bunch of different ways in a soup or stir-fried on a plate.
What about Hai Di Lao?
Hai Di Lao is a perfect place to go with just an enormous amount of people. It's the local branch of a chain of high-end hot pot restaurants that started, I think, in Shanghai. And in Shanghai, the waits are 3 or 4 hours sometimes, and you get free manicures and pedicures.
While you're waiting.
While you're waiting, people give you neck massages. Here, there are fewer amenities, but if you've been to a hot pot restaurant, you basically know what it is. Here, you get to pick your own individual pot. You don't have to share with everybody. And you get to make your own sauces, so whatever you're going to be dipping things into is going to be your own personal dipping thing. Halfway through is something that's very New Year related, is the noodle dancer comes in, who does sort of a beautiful dance with noodles as he or she is like stretching them out.
I love that, a noodle dance.
It's lovely, and it's communal. Everybody has fun at Hai Di Lao. Are you going to want Beijing duck? You might want Beijing duck.
Why not?
There's a lot of places to get it this year. I'm sort of suggesting Duck House in Monterey Park, which is a Taiwanese restaurant that has a lot of konjac specialties and like eel with sticky rice and other traditional Taiwanese foods, but also is a specialist in Beijing duck. You've got to call an hour in advance.
That's not so bad.
No. And the skin is very thin and very crisp, and it's sliced separately, and you put the skin with a little dab of bean sauce and maybe a sliver of a scallion or two, roll it into a pancake, and you're good.
That's a very good way to spend part of a day.
It's a really good way to spend your day.
Okay, what if we want chilies and fish?
I'm thinking this year maybe Hunan Mao would be a fun place to go. It's my favorite of the half dozen Hunan restaurants in the San Gabriel Valley at the moment. Their specialty is steamed fish head, which is exactly what it sounds like, a giant fish head served in a hot pot surrounded with a moat of hot peppers.
Yum.
So good. While you're there, you know, you might as well get a like a hot pot or the dish that is described on the menu as hot over spicy, which is stir fry of chilies with other kinds of chilies, seasoned with yet other chilies, and then maybe there's a little bit of pork in there.
So literally you're ordering just a plate of chilies.
Right, with a little pork. It's good.
Is it crazy hot?
No. I mean it's Hunan peppers as opposed to Thai peppers or even Sichuan peppers.
Well, that's comforting.
It is. I'm glad that you find it soothing, Evan.
Oh, my God. Now, what if we just want to commit to dumplings?
You could go to like Din Tai Fung, any of the locations, which are always good. You wait a while. It feels celebratory. You go into a big space in a new mall, either the one in Glendale or the one in Arcadia, and you just eat dumpling after dumpling, tray after tray, until you feel kind of
sloshy.
Slightly queasy.
Don't we love holidays?
I can't even think of a holiday whose food I don't like.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. That's fun to have just a slew of places.
Happy to be here, Evan. I'll see you at the Dumpling House.
That's Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, sharing the stops on his Chinese New Year food crawl in Los Angeles. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. Now let's spend a moment on a fruit often given as a good luck gift this time of year. When raw and unripe, it practically begs you not to eat it, making your mouth feel like it's covered in a cashmere sweater. When ripe, it's a mushy mess. And yet there is a way to turn it from dire to sublime. Sasha Woodruff has our story.
Yeah. And that was like five of them. Woo!
Sunoco Sakai is on a mission. Today, it's to pick as many persimmons as she can off of Nancy Nelms' tree. Nancy is perched on a ladder with pruning shears as Sunoco stands below with a box to catch the falling orange orbs.
Got it.
We're on Nancy's property, nestled on a green hillside in Topanga Canyon. When she moved here, this tree was a bit of a mystery.
The first year, I looked up at the tree and there were these beautiful orange fruits on the tree, and I said, oh, what are we going to do with those? And I took a bite of one, and it was really bitter and horrible. I spit it out, and I was like, these are awful.
There are two main types of persimmons, the fuyu and the hachia. The fuyu is squat and almost looks like a tomato. If you've ever eaten a persimmon from a store, this is probably the one you've eaten. The other kind is the hachia. It's acorn-shaped and is so astringent that many first-time eaters are shocked when they bite into it. It can turn your mouth into sandpaper and turn you off to the fruit forever. This is the kind of persimmon that Nancy has in her backyard.
You can't eat it like an apple. You know, they have to completely ripen and become like this gelatinous thing that you basically bite into or scoop it up with a spoon. Otherwise, it tastes very bitter.
Of course, waiting for the fruit to completely ripen introduces another problem: squirrels and birds that descend for a meal. Japanese and other Asian cultures have a tradition of making the best of the fruit. Sunoco is known for her soba noodle and onigiri classes. She also introduced Nancy to hoshigaki, a Japanese way of preserving persimmons. Today, they're harvesting fruit for classes Sunoco is teaching.
There is a cluster of them over there. Maybe we need to move the ladder or
Okay. It's so funny because most of those people that are giving me the fruit don't even know how to eat the fruit or don't like the fruit. But it's kind of a new way of drying fruit that I think American people are really interested in trying. And I've been teaching these classes for the last 3 or 4 years, but it's slowly becoming more popular.
The Hoshigaki tradition comes from Asia, but Asian immigrants brought it to California. Laurence Haubin works with Penryn Orchard Specialties, which sells the dried hoshigaki, and also works to preserve the legacy food.
It's an artisanal process. It is ancestral. It's been done for hundreds of years, initially in Asia, and for well over 100 years here in California.
It's a labor-intensive process done by hand. Each fruit must be picked and peeled in a specific way and massaged every day for about a month. A few weeks later, students have gathered in Sunoko's backyard as she walks them through how to preserve the persimmons.
You see the difference between the ones on top and the ones on bottom? Is that these look really smooth, right? So these were peeled with a peeler, a fruit peeler.
The unpeeled fruit is scattered around a table, ready for the students to prepare. 9-year-old Amadeo Pinto took this same class last year and loved it so much he is taking it again with his mother. It was a children's book that got him interested.
It was about, like, a family of mice who go live in the wild and, like, they build a house and they're, like, picking persimmons and then they dry them and then my mom told me about this, and then I realized it might be the same kind of thing, and then I got really inspired by it.
He explains how he and his mom will massage the peeled fruit to help the sugars come out.
Then we take them home, and we'll hang them up in front of the window, and we're gonna kind of like squish them like you're squishing a baby's cheeks, but not too hard, actually, so not really squishing.
Sunoko then starts to show the first step of the process. She picks up a hard persimmon and carefully moves a paring knife around the stem.
The first stab is like at an angle, and you have to get your blade in front of the stem. It's not the knife that's moving, it's your hand that's going to move.
Then she removes the rest of the skin in vertical cuts, exposing its mango-colored flesh.
See it? My hand is moving, but not my knife.
She shows the students how to tie a slipknot and attach 2 peeled fruit to a string to hang in the sun to dry. She explains how the sugars emerge as the fruit dries.
If you really look closely, some of them are starting to crystallize. So if you're a really good massager, it's going to be, see the top has some whites? Mm-hmm. It's going to be coated in white. And the white is not mold.
Over the month-long drying process, they shrivel and transform into a deep maroon color dusted with white. The texture is smooth and sweet when you bite into it. All the astringency is gone. In Japan, you can pay up to $15 for one fruit. Because of its color, it's often given around this weekend's Lunar New Year to bring good luck.
It's red with the white coating. Red and white are symbols of good luck, especially red, you know, the fire color.
For Good Food, I'm Sasha Woodruff.
That piece comes to us thanks to support from KCRW's Independent Producer Project. Find out more about how to preserve persimmons on our blog. Go to blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, we pivot from persimmons to peppers. Don't go anywhere. I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Because they're so easy to cultivate, dry well, and are simple to transport, the affordable chili pepper and its profuse varieties have been what Judith Finlayson refers to as gastronomic democratizers since the days of Columbus. Who knew that chili could be the great equalizer? Power to the pepper, people.
That's a great introduction. You know, I tend to call them, what I say in the intro is that they're the little engine that could. And that probably that's part of why I like them so much, because they were kind of this little David taking on the Goliath of black pepper and other more expensive spices, which were very esoteric. And Columbus discovered them in the New World, and the Portuguese traders, who were really the ones who were responsible for their proliferation everywhere, and brought them to the Old World. And they just took over. And when you think about it, cuisines like Thai food, Indian. There were no chilies in those cuisines until the chili pepper arrived with the Portuguese traders and really took over the food. And that's because people were desperate for flavor. Their food was basically a very bland starch, and other spices were very difficult to grow or expensive or whatever. And here was this little chili pepper that came along, grew everywhere, and brought tremendous flavor and spice to everything.
And when I think about it, too, I think about a color palette that must have been pretty, you know, I mean, it must have had some colors from the natural world. But then you add that red, and all of a sudden, everything's different.
Absolutely. Red and green and yellow and orange and all the wonderful colors of chilies and all the various flavors. That's what people tend to miss about chilies. They tend to think that they're all about heat. And I have to say, like, I'm not a chili head. I admire those people who say that they can eat these things like the Trinidad scorpion and tell you how hot it is. I couldn't do that. But they do have wonderful, different flavors. Earthy, citrusy, fruity. I mean, when you hear a true connoisseur of chilies, it's almost like listening to someone talk about wine, you know, the minerality, smoky, cherry-like, herbal. So they really bring a lot to any dish in addition to heat.
And when they first started proliferating all over the world, they seemed to bring a pretty immediate focus on their medicinal and healthful uses.
Absolutely. And they're very, very good for you. They're wonderful blood thinners. They're loaded. They're incredibly nutrient dense. So they provide a huge number of standard vitamins and minerals. But, you know, initially the idea was that people in the past used things like chilies to disguise the taste of rotting food. But evolutionary scientists have now been looking at it, and they've actually been saying that there is an evolutionary advantage to chilies. Because they are natural antibiotics and so on, they destroy pathogens. So people who ate a lot of chilies had a better gene pool that they could pass on to their descendants.
That's so interesting.
Isn't it fascinating?
Now, while we're on this subject, you have an essay in the book, The Chili Pepper Bible, about the history of the chili in Great Britain, which I found fascinating because I think a lot of us think about chilies and the British as mostly an Indian link, but it goes beyond that.
That's true. And it was very interesting to me to research that because, of course, like everyone, I thought chilies came to England thanks to the Raj. But there's a good case to be made for the fact that they actually came with Catherine of Aragon, whom you will remember was Henry VIII's wife. She was the daughter of Ferdinand and Isabel, the King and Queen of Spain. And they were the monarchs to whom Columbus actually delivered the chili peppers as part of his, you know, riches that he brought from the New World. Although they weren't too excited about the chili peppers, and I think they were very disappointed that it wasn't black pepper. But anyway, she was familiar with chilies, and she may well have brought them to England. But in any case, they were around, and you start to see them being written about in herbals in the 1500s. And Culpeper used them medicinally, and he was writing about them. And then they were turning up in things, country houses and so on. And there was a whole kind of competition, really, to kind of make hot sauces and whatever. And then so by the time the Raj was in place, people were really, really primed for chilies. So you had things then like curry houses popping up in London.
Earlier on, did they realize that chili peppers could be used as a remedy for scurvy?
I don't think they knew specifically for scurvy, but they did know that they had health benefits, and Culpeper was writing about that. If I remember correctly, he saw them as a digestive aid, among other benefits.
Tell me who Culpepper is.
He was a herbalist, and his name is still around, like Culpepper Shops and so on. And he wrote a herbal, I think it was published in the 1600s, if I remember correctly, off the top of my head. But don't forget that these people were really like the pharmacists of today, because they didn't have synthetic drugs. They didn't have pharmaceuticals. And they were using plants and studying plants as natural remedies. So there really is a lot of very solid wisdom in a lot of what these people were writing.
Is capsaicin still being used now in its natural form, or is it only used in its synthetic form?
I believe it's being used in its natural form. It's used in topical creams, particularly for things like arthritis and so on. It's very good as a pain reliever. They are exploring it as an antibiotic because, as you know, bacteria-resistant antibiotics are becoming a problem. So people are looking more and more to the past, I think, in terms of dealing with some of the problems that we're having, health problems, and certainly they're looking into chilies and some of the things that are going on there. One thing that interested me about chilies that surprised me when I was researching the book was the whole idea of terroir. And there are a number of chilies that have or are attempting to achieve protective geographical status. And this is the idea that in particular regions, would the chili peppers develop what is recognized as the ultimate features of the chili?
Would this be something like the La Vera pepper in Spain?
Yes, and Pimientos Plet is the big one. I kind of knew that in the back of my mind without really putting it together, but it has been a DOP pepper for some time. India, they're getting protected geographical status for a number of peppers, including the ghost pepper. In Spain, they have a number of them. Even in northern Greece, we tend not to think of Greece as being a cuisine that's associated with chilies. But in the north and in Macedonia, they do eat a lot of chilies. Hungarian paprika, which is kind of one of the ultimate ones, Hungarian and Spanish, they have been submitted it to the EU for PDO status. But as far as I know, they don't have it yet, which I think is fascinating because to me, that would have been a no-brainer.
In doing all the research that you did for this book, what is one recipe that you became particularly attached to that you'd like to share with us?
Gosh, that's kind of like asking a parent who their favorite child is.
Pick something from the Balkans, because I think that, as you said, it's an area that people don't really think of as having a big chili history, but in fact does.
Well, it would have to be Avar, because that was a new discovery for me. My Pilates instructor introduced me to it. She went out and bought me a bottle of it. And it's roasted red peppers, eggplant, garlic, a little olive oil, salt, some lemon juice, and some hot paprika. I actually was able to use Balkan paprika, which she brought back to me from Serbia. These hot, slightly spicy, but roasted pepper kind of relishes are very, very popular in the Balkans. And I don't know how I lived without really knowing about it. And it's fascinating because I had my book club over about 10 days ago, and I made Avar for them. And they just loved it. They all went home. They wanted the recipe, and they're going to make it, and they'd never had it. And so I think it's really due for a kind of burst of popularity. I think we're all going to be keen on Avar.
I can't end this conversation without, of course, asking you what the hottest chili is right now of this moment. It seems as soon as one is crowned, it's soon toppled from its throne by some other one.
It's true. As far as I know, it is still the Carolina Reaper. But it is tough competition, and boy, those guys are really committed to growing the hottest pepper. And they say they are a very interesting bunch of people, and they say that they can actually bite into one of these peppers and tell you what the Scoville heat units are.
That's frightening.
I find that it's certainly not my cup of tea. Thank you very much.
So what is the range of the Carolina Reaper on the Scoville scale?
Close to 2 million, I believe. Just to put that in perspective, I think it was the ghost pepper that broke the million mark maybe about 6 or 7 years ago. And that was considered really extraordinary. So there's really a lot of very, very competitive heat creation going on in the chili world right now.
Well, thank you so much, Judith.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Judith Finlayson's new book is The Chili Pepper Bible. We close out the show at the farmer's market to hear what you might make from sprouted almonds. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman.
We do raw sprouted almond milk, and anytime you sprout an almond, you release a phytic acid in a seed. And that's kind of the way nature provides all the animals food, by sprouting it and growing it into something in the next season. So by doing that at the market, we're kind of simulating what nature's doing, and we're seeing very great effects of eating healthier.
That's John Carpenter of Fat Uncle Farms talking to Laura Avery at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
Let's talk about the process of sprouting an almond.
I take sprouting the most serious because it's the beginning of the life of the almond, so it's all about quality of water. Alkaline water is integral for a proper sprout, and I use something called a fulvic acid. A fulvic acid is a decalcifier of a cell structure. So by incorporating all these different foods together, we're opening the cell structure, we're flowing information in and out, we're getting more living enzymes, B enzymes, and more calcium. So it's creating a whole new level of food.
And then almond milk, you can drink it, you can use it for everything that you would use dairy for.
Exactly, yeah. You can use it in baking. I've used it in cookies. I make ice cream that's raw sprouted out of it, that's all plant-based. The whole thing about making something out of the almond milk is never losing the living almond milk in the process. So ice cream allows me to get it to more people who could possibly benefit from these living enzymes.
Okay, and what is good about almond enzymes? People always talk about their health benefits. What are those?
If you look at the way that a sprouted almond reacts to life, it grows in vitamin B enzymes and calcium. Calcium way more than dairy, which is a great alternative to eating dairy milk. You can get way more enzymes, proteins, calciums in these nut milks.
Tell us about how the almonds are growing on the farm.
All the almonds are grown in Wasco, which is about 2 hours away near Bakersfield. We have a dry organic practice, so no pesticides are used. A heavy part of the almond industry is the bee farm. So we import bees to pollinate all of our flowers, creating a completely symbiotic relationship with bees, almonds, and the local agriculture. Without the bees, we lose the capability of growing any fruit, and we have nothing left except dead bees and dead fruit. You have to really be careful when you start farming. You have to look at the soil quality, you have to look at the air quality, the water quality. Here at Fat Uncle, we're a dry farm, so we water with rainwater. We're not taking water, buying water, storing water. We're using only the highest quality ingredients and farming practices.
Now this year we've finally had some rain, but for the last 5 years we've been basically in drought conditions. How's that affected the almonds?
It's been a very tough few years for the almonds. We just do what we can, and we trust that the rain will come in the following season. The last 5 years have been very difficult, and that's what's resulting in rising prices in almonds. And you should definitely be checking with the quality of farm you're buying from.
Now, the almonds go through a cycle where they're green, and a lot of people now are realizing you can buy green almonds. What are those like, and who buys them?
It's a huge trend coming from Europe. A lot of the European countries have been soaking green almonds and enjoying them as a snack for a long time. Here in the United States, almond farming is relatively new, so it's starting to become more popular with wider spectrum cuisines and restaurants in the town. I think with the green almonds, it's a really great opportunity to shave them and put them in salads. It's adding a totally different dynamic of flavor from an almond, which is a little sour and bitter, which you would never experience unless you knew about green almonds.
Right. And what is the season for the green almonds?
That's kicking off around February, ending in about May.
Okay, and how many flavors of your roasted flavored almonds do you have? They're all so good.
I think right now we have between 8 and 9 flavors. They range. Some of them go in and out of season. Garlic and herb are really popular. Lemon pepper that are sprouted are great as crouton alternatives in salads. Mm. So as long as you're willing to get creative with almonds, there's almost no end to it.
That was John Carpenter. He's got to run back to the booth now and sell some more almonds. And now we're just going to have a brief chat here with Amanda Bergman. She's also been with Fat Uncle for quite a while. Is there a particular area of California that's exceptionally good for growing almonds?
I would say pretty much all of California, as long as it's in a climate that gets cold enough, but also gets warm enough and doesn't have too much freezing. Mm-hmm. We do get some freezing temperatures. We just had a really hard freeze, but the almonds kind of like that once in a while. It helps to stress them a little bit, but it also brings the blooms. And so we're going to actually be getting blooms here within the next month, and that's the most beautiful time of year. It's a great experience to see all that.
How are they harvested?
They actually have a machine that goes in. It's a tractor, and it shakes the tree. They lay out tarps, and all of the almonds fall to the ground into the tarps, and then we dump them into big wooden crates.
So the almond trees, I always thought they were big, like kind of like oak trees, but I guess they're not because they have to be fairly small to shake them, right?
I would say that a full-grown almond tree that's producing at its maximum capacity is approximately 10 feet to maybe 15 feet tall, mm-hmm. which isn't that tall for a tree. When I was growing up, the way I could tell the difference between an almond tree and a pistachio tree was the way it looked. The pistachio tree is nice and combed. And then the almond tree looks like a bad hair day because it's just bushy and wild. But they're actually pretty short, so not very tall.
That was Amanda Bergman. She and John Carpenter both are longtime boosters for Fat Uncle Farm. And so do stop by and visit them, taste all the variety of nuts, and treat yourself to some of that almond milk. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
That is it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen to the show at kcrw.com or on KCRW's mobile podcasting app. As always, many thanks to the Good Food team. And in addition, Phil Richards. They are
Abby Fentress Swanson,
Laurel Garcia,
Joseph Stone.
Hey, Abby, here's mine.
Camellia Say,
Joel Stein,
and Ronnie Mickelson.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more good food.